CF United, the premier Cold Fusion Conference by TerraTech Programming. Created by developers for developers.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. The developers where I work, we have an ongoing bet. It's $10 for the first person who can bring in a development magazine that does not have the word Ajax on the cover. We have Dr. Dobbs Journal with Ajax, Asynchronous, JavaScript, and XML, JDJ, Supercharged, JSF, Ajax, Data Fetch. Here's the new Cold Fusion Developers Journal. They're advertising the one-day Ajax seminar. And Network Computing has Crash Course, Sick of Sluggish Web GUIs, Ajax to the Rescue. So Ajax is obviously having a very big impact on our industry. The question is, what is that impact? Well, what Ajax is really going to do to the web is it's going to change users' expectations. It's going to change their expectations of what is standard, and it's going to change their expectations about what is a good website. In other words, Ajax used correctly is going to be able to improve the usability of your websites. Websites are going to be more intuitive, they're going to be easier to use. However, Ajax itself is simply a technology. And I think we're all familiar with the concept that, you know, maybe this is the new hype for this year, but simply building a website and tossing some Ajax onto it isn't really going to do anything. In fact, it might end up making your websites more complicated. So the real issue is whether or not you're going to use these technologies correctly. And what it really comes down to is the concept of usability. What is good usability? And if you understand the basic concepts of usability, you can then use Ajax, or you can use your own skill set, use Cold Fusion or Flex or Flash or whatever it is, to build usable, user-friendly, intuitive websites. So what we're going to talk about today, then, is what is usability? My name is Doug Ward. I'm a certified advanced Cold Fusion developer. I work for the Centec Group here in Washington, D.C., and I'm currently on contract at NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I became interested in usability because most of the applications that I build at NIST, they are large-scale data collection applications where it's basically like one agency, one federal agency reporting to another federal agency. And so the users go through typically a long process where there's like 10 questions, something like that. And, you know, they go through this process, they upload documents, they answer questions, and do all of that. And I started to get frustrated because I found that a lot of my users weren't reading my directions. And it's very frustrating because you put up these long, voluminous, detailed messages about how to use the thing. And the users typically skim over that and don't really actually read your directions. So I started looking into usability and started studying up on what usability is all about. And I have found that by applying some basic principles of usability, understanding some of the basic concepts, you can improve your websites dramatically. Most of what's going to be spoken about here at the conference is pretty heady stuff. You know, getting into CFCs and stored procedures and populating arrays and all that stuff. That's pretty difficult stuff, you know? That's pretty smart stuff. Usability isn't particularly difficult. However, it's simply something that you actually have to attend to. It's something you have to pay attention to. So if you take all of the skills that you already have and that you're going to learn here at CF United, understand a little bit about usability and adhere to these principles, you will see an improvement in your websites. Your users will be happier, your boss will be happier, everyone will be happier. So that's our agenda today. We are basically going to answer two questions. The first one is, what is usability? The second one is, what is usability on the web? In order to answer these questions, we are going to investigate a number of different concepts, one being cognitive friction. We'll also talk about something called the implementation model. And when we start speaking about usability on the web, we'll talk about conventions. What are conventions? How are they properly used? And how are they misused? And we'll look at a few misuses of conventions, specifically something called mystery links, happy text, and bad page structure. So that's our agenda for today. So we're going to start off with a question. What is usability? A noted usability expert by the name of Jacob Nielsen defines usability as, usability is a quality attribute relating to how easy something is to use. More specifically, it refers to how quickly people can learn to use something, how efficient they are while using it, how memorable it is, how error-prone it is, and how much users like using it. If people can't or won't use a feature, it might as well not exist. Now, you might notice that there's nothing in that definition that is specific to the web. In fact, usability can pertain to most anything. It can certainly pertain to physical objects. For instance, you're all familiar with water bottles. You know, at work you have the water cooler, right? And you have those big, huge 50-pound jugs of water. And the way they used to work is you'd have a piece of plastic around the top, so you'd tear the piece of plastic off, you know, around the top, and then you'd try to, you know, pick the thing up and angle it onto the base quickly enough so that it didn't spill down your front, right? This is, you're familiar with this. A few years ago, I started to notice that they kind of changed things. They have this new method, and you may have seen it. There's a piece of, it's like a piece of tape or something over the top of the bottle. And now the bases, the water, the base itself has a peg sticking up. And so now you pick up the water thing, and you put it over top of the peg punctures the seal, and the water goes down into where it should instead of all over you. That is making something more usable. It's a good idea. So usability can also pertain to electronics and computers, as well as physical objects. But there is a significant difference between physical objects and electronics or gadgets or whatnot. With physical objects, there's a very strong one-to-one correlation between what you do and what it does. There's an action and a reaction, and it's all perfectly obvious. For example, a car door. When you actually slam the door shut, you know, this big physical object, you slam it shut, and the reaction is you hear this big whoosh, right? And then you can kind of tell when you hear it whether or not it closed securely or not. But the concept is you do something and it reacts in a very specific and obvious way. There's a strong one-to-one correlation. Now, in regards to electronics or computers or gadgets, quite often there is a weak correlation between what you do and what it does. And a lot of times it's fairly difficult to figure out what it's doing. And this has some interesting ramifications. For one thing, with electronics, we tend to carry on more of a conversation. You know, we say something, and then it says something back to us, and then we say something again, and you sort of get into this conversation with electronics and gadgets and computers. And what happens is we tend almost to start personalizing these sorts of things a lot more so than just water bottles, because we have this relationship with these products. My wife recently bought a new iPod, and the first thing she did was she named it. Her iPod's name is Fred. And it's fairly common. We become emotionally involved with these kind of objects. That can be fun when you have an iPod, but our emotions, well, it can lead us to strange places. How many people have seen Office Space? Probably a whole lot. It's a very funny movie. It's about a bunch of guys who work at an office, and there's this classic scene where they take the fax machine out into the field, and they just beat the tar out of it. And everybody relates to it, and it's so funny because, you know, a water bottle is aggravating, but a fax machine lies, you know? It aggravates you in a different way. It's not treating you well. You have this relationship with it. So the question is, what's going on? What's the difference here? Why do we get so aggravated with electronic gadgets in this unique way? What is it? Well, there's this concept called cognitive friction. Another usability expert by the name of Alan Cooper defines cognitive friction as the resistance encountered by a human intellect when it engages with a complex system of rules that change as the problem changes. Here's an example. This is my voice recorder, and I'm about 60% sure that it's actually recording right now because there are these buttons on it, and sometimes when I press a button, it means record. But when I'm in a different mode, that same button means something else. The problem, or the rules changed as the problem changes. And I tend to get confused with the thing. I use it, you know, every couple of months to try out a presentation, but I don't remember how to use the thing, and I really dislike the thing, but I keep it because it's a really good example. So there's this concept of cognitive friction, and it's caused by these rules that change as the problem changes. The classic example of that is the VCR, right? How many people actually understand how to program a VCR? You know, that's pretty good. Well, I'll get back to that because it's very interesting. And there's probably a much higher likelihood that the people in this room actually do understand how to program a VCR than most people. So the VCR is the classic example of something that causes cognitive friction. In fact, my VCR, and I got rid of it a few years ago. At one point, one afternoon, I tried to program the thing, and I took a wrong turn somewhere, and I ended up setting it to French. And so for the next 3 years, my VCR was in French, and I could never figure out how to get it back. What was going on? So what is going on here? How do we build these gadgets that cause so much cognitive friction? Why are we doing this? Well, it has to do with something called the implementation model. The implementation model is the actual technical reason or the technical solution to a problem. Imagine an airplane. The actual reason why an airplane gets off the ground and flies, it's very complicated. It involves aerodynamics and hydraulics and very complicated electronic systems. And the actual technical solution for why the thing flies is phenomenally complex. You might understand a lot about aerodynamics, and you might be able to give some sort of eloquent explanation for why the thing flies, but it's still phenomenally complex what's actually going on. All of these gadgets that we're speaking about have an implementation model. With a VCR, the implementation model really begins at the circuit level. Right? There's some sort of circuit board, and there are few circuits here and there, and there's a schematic that explains what's going on with all the electronic circuitry and whatnot, and if this circuit is closed, this control is activated, or if this circuit is closed, this control is activated, and there's an actual physical technical implementation model that makes the thing work. You can take that implementation model and abstract it out, and start thinking of it in terms of, let's say, a flow chart, right? So everything we just spoke about in regards to circuitry of a VCR can be expressed to a large extent through a flow chart, right? If we are in set mode, you know, do this. If we are in timer mode, do this. And a flow chart can sort of be a further level, more abstract level of the actual technical implementation model. And you may know where I'm going with this. You can then take that flow chart and conceive of it in a further abstract level. This is the level that we deal at, right? Just strict code. If set mode is true, control A means timer mode, else control A means play mode. So what happens is, and to answer our question, why do we end up building these gadgets and whatnot that make people so frustrated and that create so much cognitive friction, is that often what happens is that we end up simply slapping an interface on our implementation model. In other words, all those little Boolean switches, you know, is set timer mode, there's a Boolean switch. Well, why not just give the user a control right there? You know, let the user make the decision what's going on there. And then you have another switch over here. You know, well, let's just slap a control right there. And you slap all these controls onto your implementation model, and you put it out, and what do you have? You've just built a VCR. And that is why these contraptions end up being so frustrating, because we are expecting our users to think like computers, right? Most people don't think like computers. However, we do. You know, the people in this room, we're developers, and we're paid to think like computers. And so all of this makes sense to us, and sometimes it gets pretty frustrating because we just don't understand why our users don't get it. It makes so much sense, you know? There's a schematic, you plop some stuff together, and there you have it. But what we're really doing is we're imposing the implementation model onto our users. And that results in lots of cognitive friction because our users don't think like computers. We do. So we actually have a responsibility not only to create good implementation models, but also to shield our users from that implementation model. An airplane, we don't have any expectation that the passengers on an airplane understand anything about why the thing flies. You don't have to know why something flies in order to take an airplane ride. Or even a toaster. You know, if you want to use a toaster, we don't expect that the user understands anything about the fact that when they plug it in, it's completing a circuit with the external power source and the external power generating circuit station works on some extensive grid, and who cares? The guy just wants to plug it in and make a piece of toast, right? So we need to understand the differentiation or the difference between the implementation model and the user interface. So this really brings us to the second part of the talk today, the second question we're going to deal with. Because the solution to these problems is understanding that we have to build interfaces for our users from the user's perspective, right? We have to understand what kind of expectations the user brings to using a product. We have to understand, you know, the context in which somebody uses one of these things. We have to come at the problem from a different angle. We have to come at it from the user's perspective. It's generally a concept called user-centered design. And again, the basic concept is consider your interface design from the user's perspective as opposed to from the implementation model. The most important thing about understanding how to engage in user-centered design is understanding what your users' expectations are with a specific product. And for our concerns, we're interested in what kind of expectations our users have on the web. You know, when they go to a website, what are they actually thinking? That's where we need to start building our interfaces. So we're going to talk about usability on the web. And the place we start considering usability on the web is with considering conventions. Now, what are conventions? Well, conventions are basically expectations. You know, here's a cell phone. You probably don't think about it too much, but if you open up your cell phone, the convention is you have four rows of three numbers, and you never really think about it. All phones use that convention, but if you, for some reason, wanted to design a new phone, and you designed it with two rows of six numbers across, well, that wouldn't make any sense whatsoever, right? Your users would, you might not sell more than two of these things. I don't imagine why you would sell two of these things. Another example of conventions would be like something like a magazine, right? The conventions with magazines, if I want to find an article listed on the cover, you know, there's a new story by John Updike here, so I flip in, and the convention is on, you know, very early in the magazine, there's a table of contents, right? Or if I want to find something in this magazine, you flip it open, and the convention is one of the first few pages is a table of contents. So you come to expect that. And you know, conventions are like that. On the web, there are lots of conventions, and we're going to go ahead and take a look at a couple. Now, here's a website, the AIDS Marathon, great organization. And in fact, I think this web page itself, you know, the colors are kind of inviting, and it's certainly attractive. But one of the strongest conventions on the web is typically you have some sort of navigation, some sort of primary high-level navigation along the top, or certainly, you know, a lot of times it's down the left-hand side. In this case, you don't have any navigation along the top, you don't have any navigation along the left-hand side. The primary navigation on this page is actually the bottom middle of the page. And that is not really very conventional. So when people come to this website, they have to stop and think for a little bit what's going on here. You know, where do I click and what do I do? When you actually click into the page, you then get this. So you now have up in the left-hand corner, you have a few links here, but the primary navigation is in the top right-hand corner. Another convention is here's the logo, and I would bet that it's, you know, if you visited this page, at some point, the vast majority of people are actually going to be clicking on this logo trying to get back to the home page. But it doesn't work there. It's, you know, you can get back here. But so it violates conventions. But you might be saying, well, you know, that's all right. I've seen websites that don't have navigation along the top, and I've seen websites that the only navigation is, you know, down the right-hand side or, you know, something like that. And that they very well might work. However, consider this. Here's another magazine. This is Vogue, right? The convention with magazines is that the table of contents is one of the first few pages. In Vogue, however, the table of contents is actually, you don't really get to it till page number 36. This is my wife's magazine, by the way. You don't get to it till page number 36, right? But what's actually going on here is that the publishers understand the convention of magazines. They also understand their users. So they understand that when their users come and pick up this magazine, they're going to open it up and start looking for the table of contents. They're not going to find it, but they're not going to be too upset that they have to flip through 36 pages of advertisements, you know? So the publishers, they're violating the convention, but they understand it, so they can make use of it. So, you know, if you are going to change conventions, you want to do it with the knowledge of what the convention is and what the benefits are of not adhering to that convention. Because the real issue is this on the web, and this is the heart of web usability. There's another usability expert. His name is Steve Krug, and he has written a book. If you buy one book at this convention, I highly recommend buying Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug. He wrote a book, and he has one. His first primary rule of web usability is don't make me think. Everything that he talks about is founded on the concept of don't make me think. So what is he talking about with don't make me think? Well, the concept is this. When you go to a website, you don't want to stop and consider what you need to do. You know, every time that you go to a website and actually stop and ask yourself, huh, what is that? What actually is happening is you're building up a little bit of cognitive friction, right? And what happens with cognitive friction is a lot of times you get a little bit aggravated, and suddenly you have this sort of feeling like, well, I've been here before. You know, I know where this is going to go. So the second that you start thinking and building up this cognitive friction, there's a real high tendency that you're just going to say, I'm leaving here. So when you're the fundamental concept of web usability is that you need to focus on making websites that are intuitive and that are self-explanatory and obvious. And so we're going to look at a few things that prevent that. If the basic rule is don't make me think, the next logical question is what are those things that make us think, right? When you go to the web, what are these things that make us think? We're going to look at a few things. Mystery links, happy text, and bad page structure. Any questions so far? All right. What are mystery links? We're in Washington, D.C., so it's okay that we have a political website, but this is strictly a nonpartisan presentation. But we are going to look at Senator Evan By's website. And in regards to mystery links, it becomes very interesting. You look over here, you have these words, stay up to date, right? And they're blue. They have that same color of blue that typically is a convention on the web. This color of blue typically indicates something that is clickable. But in this case, it's not. However, the image right below it, it is clickable. You know, that is a link. You go down a little bit more, and now you have the same sort of font as up here. It might be a little bit smaller, but it's the same font, but this time it's clickable. You go down there, and now you have a completely different font, probably an italicized version of the font. That's clickable. You go down here, we now have, this is actually clickable, but it's the third different kind of blue font that is clickable. You keep going down, this picture is clickable. Now we get to email here. The same sort of cursive color is up here, but this one's not clickable. And you keep going down, this one's not clickable. These images, you might think by this point, well, all images are clickable. Who knows? But these ones aren't. And again, right here, if you can see this little text, for like Washington, D.C., it's the same blue as I think was clickable up here somewhere, but it's not clickable. Right, so on this left-hand side of this web page, I don't know how many different clickable items there actually are, but what's going to happen, you might not be conscious of it, but you're going to come into the page, and everything's going to start making you think. What is this? Is this clickable? Is this not clickable? So you start to develop this cognitive friction. Excuse me one second. We couldn't get a internet connection earlier. I want to see if we can do it yet because... No. Oh, well. All right, so that's the concept of mystery links. You know, it's a very basic thing when you're designing your web pages. And this is one of those things I was talking about with all this complicated stuff that you're going to learn at this conference about CFCs and whatever it is. You know, learn this to make your links actually consistent. And for the most part, your links, especially if they're text, should be blue and underlined. If they're not, you know, maybe you have a good reason to make it so, but you should actually have a reason for why you're violating that convention. So you go back, you look at your websites, and you will find that if you update them to prevent mystery links, you'll see a big difference. Because what actually happens on the web is that people don't read. What they actually do is they just start clicking on stuff. Steve Krug's second law of usability is it doesn't matter how many times I have to click as long as each click is a mindless, unambiguous choice, right? So nobody actually goes into a website and starts reading stuff. They don't actually go and start reading. Here in this case, the Kaplan Company founded in 1817, and blah, blah, blah. And then it goes on to our mission at Claflin Equipment, blah, blah, blah. And then it goes on to our team of experienced, high qualified professionals. And nobody's actually reading any of this stuff. What this is something called happy text. And it's that text that, as developers, we always feel compelled to put something on the page that says, welcome, you know, we are committed to this, and... You know, there's lots of this text. This is what we're looking at here is the homepage of the Stanford bookstore. And all of this stuff down here, it doesn't serve any purpose because nobody actually reads that stuff. For Claflin here, what's actually going on is this link down here, this view our online medical equipment store, that is the valuable link for this website. Because what happens when you drill down into that is you actually get a list of their products. Now, you know, this might not be the prettiest thing on earth we're looking at, but it actually makes perfectly good sense. It's an alphabetical listing of all of their products. Yet they felt the necessity to provide this happy text. They felt the necessity to provide these couple paragraphs explaining who they are and what they blah, 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 and no one's going to read it. And the real problem with this is that there's a high likelihood that people are going to come in here and they're going to miss the most important link on the site. So this is the concept of happy text. Now, it also relates back to Senator Bayh's website. Because what's going to happen, again, is people are just going to start randomly clicking on stuff. Every time they click on something, it's going to reinforce that, oh, that's what we click on, right? That's the thing that it indicates that something is clickable. But as we've seen, there's no consistency here. So what's going to happen is people aren't going to come in here and really consider what it is that they want to click on and whether something makes sense that it's a link or whatever. They're just going to start moving in and clicking and clicking and clicking. And eventually... It leaves a sort of a sour taste in your mouth because you just don't know what's going on. You have to sometimes roll over and see if it is a link or whatever it may be. Now, contrast that with this site. This is a site called Bye Bye Baby. And first of all, does anybody have any question what this site is about? Is there any question whatsoever? But yet, is there any explanation? There's really no explanation. Helping you with those first few steps, that is the explanation. That and the picture of the baby, and that's it. And if you notice, you can pretty much go all over the entire site, and pretty much the entire thing is clickable. If you notice the cursor, there's really nothing that isn't clickable on this website, because they understand the convention. They understand how users actually use the web. They come in, they don't read your happy text. They come in, they look around, they look for something to click on, and bang. You know, they click on it and go. So, for example, this was, again, the Stanford bookstore that I used in the presentation last year. And they had all this happy text here that served no purpose. And I was putting together the presentation for this year, and they updated their website. So this is actually much better. Right, this doesn't have as much happy text. It has some clear headings, and what you can actually click on is fairly obvious here. But it's completely an improvement over this sort of thing with all this happy text. They actually had happy text in French, and I didn't quite understand that, although they are very smart people. That's probably it. But contrast that with their current website. So the other thing we want to look at or consider that makes you stop and think is bad page structure. Now, this is sort of a gratuitous example that I've been using for a while, and I know it's not real representative of what's really out there, but I just love this site. I especially love the moose in the middle of it here. This is the homepage of Epoxy Polymers. And, you know, if you want to get a 15-gallon basic number blush, it's pretty obvious how you get there, right? And if it's not, they do have right here, still confused about the layout of our website. So they do have the help right there. Again, I acknowledge that's a pretty gratuitous example. But in terms of page structure, the people in the back, do you have any question whatsoever what this is? And it's perfectly obvious, right? It's a newspaper, and I'm sure you can't actually read anything, but I'm also sure that you can probably understand the page structure, what's going on. You have headings here, you've got the title up there, you've got a heading here. You don't really have to think about, you know, what this thing is. You understand the page structure. There's a clear hierarchy, what's going on. And so you don't stop and think. You just move in, you understand the convention, so you point and you shoot. You start clicking. When you're designing your web pages, it's important to keep that in mind as well. And in fact, the New York Times recently revised their website, and it's starting to mimic, to a very large extent, an actual newspaper. And so they're using the convention of, you know, a good page structure to convey something very easily. Because what's really going on the web is that your users are driving by at 65 miles an hour. You don't have time to sit there and explain that, well, Jerry's Burger Joint, you know, we're committed professionals, we're committed to excellent burgers, and explain about how our employees all gently place the lettuce on each particular patty and all of that, and the excellence of Jerry's Burger. You don't have time to do that. On the web, you state what it is and you state how to get to it. Or in other words, what's really going on the web is we're designing billboards. It's a good concept to keep in mind when you're designing your web pages. Building web pages is really billboard design 101. So users don't read, they scan. So your happy text, they're not going to read it. They're going to scan. So you don't explain, you direct. Again, your users aren't going to sit there and read all of your complicated instructions. And finally, you need to have a clear visual hierarchy, like a billboard. So let's take a look at a good example of putting it all together. How many of you are familiar with, you know what, give me one moment. Luckily, I downloaded copies of all of these locally, so we have something to look at. Oh, well, whatever. How many of you have been to classmates.com? All right. And again, let me ask you, is there any question about what this website is about? Is there any question whatsoever? How much explanation is there about this website? How much text is there explaining who these people are and how it works and what you're going to get and all of that stuff? There's none. However, the way you progress through the site, in my opinion, it's one of the most phenomenal sites on the web. Now, I'm not so crazy about the fact that I get emails from them and will get emails from them for the next 40 years, but the site is really impressive. You come in, and it directs you. I graduated in, so click on Pennsylvania. First letter of your city, P. Select city you graduated in, Pittsburgh. First letter of school attended, F. Choose the actual school itself, boom. And just like that, you're five or six clicks into the website. They really, the total number of words used for instruction, I don't know, it might have been 20 words or something like that. There are no instructions whatsoever. But what has happened is they have used all of the conventions of the web correctly. They've supported the concept that what users are actually going to do is come into a website and start clicking, and they have built up, instead of stating, you know, we are reputable and we are dependable, what they've actually done is establish that fact because their website is proving to be so easy to use and so intuitive to use that you get five or six steps in here. Thanks. What's going on? Oh, yeah, all right. Well, let me take a look. Wrong cable. All right. So, you know, with classmates.com, there's no explanation. You go through the process, and by the time you get five or six steps in, you know, you've built up a sort of confidence level in what's going on, or they just seem to be competent, they make sense. So then you submit your information, and again, you get emails for the next 40 years. So that in a, basically is what usability on the web is all about. And what we've learned today is what usability is. We spoke about cognitive friction. We spoke about the implementation model. We learned about conventions on the web. Spoke about mystery links, happy text, and bad page structure. I'm a little bit ahead of the game here because I cut out a few sites we're going to look at because we didn't have internet connection. But put all this stuff together, and why is this important to you? And it's important to you because if you recall what we spoke about earlier, Ajax is having a big impact on our industry, and it's going to raise the level of user expectations. It's going to actually change conventions. And it's going to, when used correctly, dramatically improve the usability of websites. And so good websites are going to be clearly distinguished from bad websites. And if you're able to actually create, you know, usable, straightforward, easy-to-use websites, your websites will stand out like a sore thumb. I'm going to post this talk on my website. These are the books that I referenced here, and I'd like to now open it up for questions if you have any. Yes. You know, Steve Krug's book, Don't Make Me Think, has a few chapters on usability, you know, on a dime. And there's a big fallacy that in order to do usability testing, you have to have some real extensive program and bring in, you know, hundreds of users or whatever it is. And that's not the case. His recommendation is it's 100% better to test one user than to test no users. So my advice, and I actually do it a lot, is certainly if you have the opportunity to test your applications with the actual end users that you know are going to use it. In my case, when I build these applications at NIST, a lot of times we actually know the end users who are going to be sitting down and using it. That's the best case scenario. However, if you don't actually have those users, it's very helpful to just use anybody. I actually, my favorite usability testing person is my mom. I test a lot of what I build with my mom. My mom is very intelligent and very capable, but she doesn't care about computers. And so it really makes a big difference if I can put up some sort of interface and sit my mom in front of it and, you know, does this make any sense to you at all? And you'll be amazed at how useful something like that can be. I, as developers, we tend to, and I suffer from this too, is sometimes I get really, you don't want to show your stuff, you know, because you think, oh, it's gonna, I'm gonna keep it to myself. And at the end we'll show it. So you really have to overcome that, that fear of actually showing your interfaces as often and as early and as repeatedly as you can. So at NIST, we constantly are showing everything that we do to our users and validating whether or not it makes any sense. I do want to say that you don't necessarily want to turn over the design process to your users. They're not experts on conventions. What you're really looking to do is validate what you're doing with your users. But sometimes, you know, if you don't control the process, you just build everything that they say they want. And a lot of times that's not appropriate. But you do want to validate that what you're building, what you're bringing to the table, is making sense to them. Other questions?
What are the downsides of using Ajax?
The downside of using Ajax at this point primarily is accessibility. Especially with the federal government, we're required to meet, you know, the 508 accessibility laws. And if you recall earlier in the talk, I spoke about how with physical objects, there's an action and a reaction, or an action and an obvious reaction. Ajax is great. However, it's quite possible to initialize things or have things occur because of Ajax and not make it obvious what just happened. And sometimes from the usability standpoint, that's the primary concern, is that if, let's say, you choose a select option, and by choosing that select option, it goes back to the database and it refreshes a whole bunch of fields. It's really hard to actually make that accessible, because somehow you have to identify to the users what actually happened. And if you're blind, if you're using the web with a screen reader, the technology is kind of iffy on indicating to users that something changed on the page. And it's one of the primary requirements of 508 accessibility. You have to make what you're doing accessible both to all people. So if somebody is sight impaired and you're changing stuff on the page, but you're not making it obvious what's going on, you've got a real serious accessibility problem. So that's the real challenge with Ajax right now. Questions? Yeah, that's a great question. And the question is, how do you deal with bosses or whomever who want to put their design ideals ahead of usability? And this is a tremendous advantage to the concept of conventions. How many of you are familiar with this concept? You work on an application for a long time. You're really proud of what you've built.
it's a phenomenal, you know, in your mind, this is a phenomenal application that you're ready to roll out. So you have a big demo planned. You get everybody around the table. You put up your application. You're ready to start moving into your application to demo it. And the boss or the client says, you know what? Why is that word in green? And shouldn't it be in blue? Yeah. And then somebody else over here says, yeah, no. That should be on the left side, and it should be red. You know. And then what happens is you end up going around the table for the next 20 minutes, and everybody's giving their opinion about what should be going on here. And you know, by the time they're done with that, everyone's mad at everybody else, and you don't really pay attention to your application. But the proper response to that is two things. One, if it's a violation of a convention, if they're recommending something that is just a straight violation of a convention, like if they come in and say, well, let's move the primary navigation to the center bottom, well, you know, you can say, sure, but you understand that's like creating a cell phone with two rows of six numbers. Do you really want to do that? And the other response is, well, there's no way that we can tell because there's not a right answer. So the only thing we can do is confirm it with our users. And instead of having a 20-minute conversation about what color the link should be, you can stop that conversation in 10 seconds by saying, well, you know what, we're going to do some testing this week, and we'll find out if the users are, you know, if that makes sense for the users. And so that's how you deal with it. So we are going to wrap it up unless there is any other... One more question, yes. One screen, yes. So I thank you all for coming out. And please do me a favor. It's really important to us that you fill out the evaluations. So let me know what I did right, what I did wrong. And I hope you found something valuable out of it. And again, email me if you have any questions. And thank you so much.
Thank you for listening, and we hope we will see you at CF United 2007. This has been a production by TerraTech Programming. For more information, go to www.cfunited.com.